move your life into hyper-reality, I'm sure that you will like it. This is the world where all your dreams come true. Here you will always be popular. Your tummy will always tingle with excitement. You will find the perfect partner here, or partners. It's kind of like a highlight reel with all the best parts that life has to offer, where you can have the lifestyles of the rich and famous and still hang with your friends on the street. Here it is always New Year's Eve, Christmas morning, and your birthday all rolled into one. Here you are the most important person in the world. It's all here for you. Look over there. It's Paris Hilton doing Pilates with David Beckham.
The problem with hyper-reality is we don't live there. We live here. We live here in reality. We see the hyperreal world as something which can help us escape from what we perceive as this everyday boring life. If we can just get that product or improve our sex lives or lose that weight or find that bunch of cool friends, get that luxury car or go on an overseas trip, then we can escape this world and enter a world of real meaning. We can't live in the hyperreal world. When you think about it, it's basically a media creation. It's almost totally disconnected from everyday life. I guess deep down we all wish our lives could be as glamorous as those of the people we see in magazines, but we live here, we live in reality. The problem with hyper-reality is that it tricks us. It offers us a few weeks in an overseas city or the honeymoon period of a relationship and says, hey, your whole life can be like this. But not so. All relationships get over their honeymoon period. People get, you know, sick and tired of other people's annoying habits. The overseas holiday has to end. And even if you kept living in that country, by the end of it, it'd become boring and mundane. The fact of the matter is, we all live in reality. Now, things get a little bit tricky here because on one hand, our culture is telling us that we have to move all of our lives into the hyperreal world to be happy. But then we're realizing that we can't live in that world. We actually live in the world of reality. But the tricky bit is that occasionally, despite us living in reality, we have these glimpses, these touches where the two worlds of reality and hyperreality overlap. It may be a fantastic date or you buy a new car. And for that moment, you feel like you're in hyperreality. But the problem is that moment doesn't last. We have to return to reality. So many people keep trying to prolong those moments, but no matter how much you do that, you're always going to come back to reality.
I wish I could talk like him. It would make everything I say so much more interesting. See, if we're really honest with ourselves, we see this all the time in our own lives. We even feel like we're missing out on life if we don't achieve this perfect hyper-real existence sometimes. What the media tells us we should have. And so you have the father who works this extraordinary number of hours so that his family can live in a certain lifestyle. Or this girl who spends all of her money just buying clothes so that she can look like this model that she sees in movies and on television, only to find that after all of the money is gone and all the clothes are purchased, she's still underneath it all just herself. Then our disillusionment kind of builds either way, because either we get all the stuff that we're looking for, right, and this hyperreal buzz maybe lasts for a week or a day or an hour, right? And then we suddenly discover that the dream is just as impossible as we always thought it was. Or we don't get what we want, and we feel like we've been robbed of life. And that's when we start to get this nagging feeling. It's this nagging feeling that life just isn't what it should be. It's even worse if there's this vague feeling of never being fulfilled, as if that weren't bad enough. Sometimes our world is rocked by disaster, by broken relationships, by disease. by things that we can't control, maybe by even the death of someone close. And that nagging feeling then becomes more than we can bear. Because life isn't what it should be. And we say to ourselves, why? Why is this world so messed up? Well, I want to introduce you to someone this morning who felt that same way. And it comes, his name is Elijah. Just grab the Bibles under your chairs, and if you would, just turn to 1 Kings 19. And this is page 351, if you're using that Bible, page 351. 1 Kings 19. So let me just give you a little bit of background here. There's this really awful, evil king ruling over the country of Israel. His name was Ahab. So you have the evil king Ahab. All of these people are worshiping false idols, false gods, okay? And all of the good prophets of the true God have been killed, and all of these evil prophets are kind of running everything. And the head of all the evil prophets is named Jezebel, and she's this evil queen, you know, to Ahab the king. So Elijah's like the only one left. There's this horrible famine and drought that's going on, and it's seriously like there's been no food for like almost 3 years. I mean, people are just eating whatever they can get by on. And this famine just didn't happen. This famine is from God, because God has noticed their evil, and he's going to have this famine strike them as punishment for it. So Elijah decides to challenge these false prophets, okay? So he's like, I'm going to have a sacrifice off, okay? So the person who's, or the prophets whose God sends fire, okay, will win the sacrifice off, and that will be the true God. So the, you know, evil prophets, there's like 450 of them, and they're like, you know, doing all the stuff they can to get their God to send fire, and nothing happens. So Elijah's making fun of them and all this stuff, and finally he says, okay, enough. And he kneels down and he prays, and God sends this massive fire from heaven, consumes the whole sacrifice. And then all the people are like, God is the true God. And then they repent and they decide to serve him, and they chase down all the false prophets and they kill them. And then Elijah thinks, this is it. And he kneels down and he prays, and God sends a storm just because Elijah asked for it. He sends a storm, and rain comes, and the famine ends. So Elijah's just had this huge triumph, two huge triumphs, winning over the prophets and, you know, God sending a storm just for him. Now, this is where our story picks up, because when Jezebel, the evil queen, the most powerful enemy that he has ever faced, finds out what Elijah did and what happened, she's really, really mad. And it picks up in this passage right here. Now, Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done, and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, may the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like one of them. Now, just in case you didn't get that, she just said, I'm going to kill you. Okay. Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. And when he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there. So he's just fleeing, all right? While he himself went a day's journey into the desert, he came to a broom tree, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. I've had enough, Lord, he said. Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. Then he lay down under the tree and fell asleep. And we'll stop there. So Elijah is escaping. Now, you know, it almost makes me laugh when I look at this, because, I mean, you can imagine the interview that would be done right after this. It would be like, you know, Elijah, we hear that you have just called fire from heaven, destroyed 450 evil prophets, and God sent a storm just for you because you asked for it. Now, I bet you find it pretty funny that Jezebel thinks she can kill you. And he's like, she what? And he runs. And it seems so silly, because it's like, God just called fire from heaven for you. How ridiculous is it that you're afraid of one person? And yet, don't we do this all the time? God is so faithful to us, and there's one little thing that we just feel like we have to get away from. Running away from the things that we don't want to face. So really, we can't be too hard on him after all, because we do it too. We are professionals at escaping. At escaping from fear and worry. At escaping from pain and shame and guilt from the past. Maybe from boredom or emptiness in life, that just nagging empty feeling that we get when everything's quiet and we slow down. Escaping from authority and restraints that we don't want on ourselves. Escaping from relational and emotional problems that we have. Financial trouble. Crushing responsibility. Our own brokenness and sinfulness. Fear of change. Whatever it is, we're professionals at escaping from it. And here's how we do it. Every person has their own thing that they need to escape from desperately. And every person has their own way of escaping. And if you watch yourself, you will notice that you do this too. You just have to figure out what it is. Some of the means of escape that we use. Busyness. We just stay as absolutely busy as we can because the moment we slow down, that nagging feeling that life isn't what it should be comes back. And we start getting depressed. So we just stay busy all the time. How about entertainment? We just entertain ourselves into numbness so we can't feel anything. Now this is different from just getting some relaxation. I'm not talking about that being a problem. I'm talking about when we are addicted, we have to be entertained in order to escape from whatever this thing is. Experience. We always have to just be moving, going to a new place, a new travel destination, whatever it is, experiencing something new. Novelty, just the sake of having something new. Our possessions. I have this problem. When I'm feeling down, I just want to go buy some new tech gadget. Maybe it's, for you, it's clothes or whatever, but some people just want to buy things. Our kids. It's awesome that we love our kids, but when we try to live through them as an escape from our own lives, that's a problem. When they have to be successful because we have to feel like we're successful. Any relationship where we use another person instead of truly loving them. Numbing, addictions. If I just need a drink so that I don't feel that pain anymore. I just need a buzz because I'm bored. And so we numb the pain. And then one of the ones that I think is the most insidious, one of the worst that we don't even notice that we do, is living in a fantasy world. Whether it's men, you know, going after pornography, or men or women doing that, actually, because it's just as rampant sometimes with women. Or those romance novels that you just have to read and get sucked into because your own relationship, you feel, is lacking. Or maybe it's just television shows. You just have to experience the buzz of being in this story. The point is, I think you understand where I'm going with this. I don't know what it is for you, but you need to figure that out. Answering those questions, what disillusions you, and how do you try to escape it, are the beginning of healing in this process. So let's keep going. Let's look at how gently God treats Elijah in spite of his running away. Then he, that's Elijah, lay down under the tree and fell asleep. And all at once an angel touched him and said, "Get up and eat." He looked around, and there by his head was a cake of bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank and then lay down again. The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, "Get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you." So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and spent the night. So look at how gently that God takes care of him. The first thing that God does is let him sleep. The second thing that God does is feed him, because he knows that Elijah is hungry and tired. And Pastor Fred sometimes uses this phrase, halt, when we are hungry, when we're angry, when we're lonely, or when we're tired. We don't make good decisions. So the first thing that you have to do when you're feeling one of these ways, just like Elijah was feeling, is you have to stop, halt, and then take care of those things. Go eat something. Go get some rest before you make any decisions or decide to try to escape. So after God feeds him, Elijah begins to move beyond this directionless, terrified escape and into a meaningful journey. He moves 40 days of intentional movement, intentional journey toward Mount Horeb, which was the same mountain where God gave the Ten Commandments to the people of Israel. This number 40 is a number of testing. The people of Israel wandered for 40 years in the same wilderness where Elijah was wandering now. So this number 40 is very intentional, the number of testing. And he wanders on this long, slow journey of testing and of preparation before he was ready to hear what God had to say to him. Now, during this 40 days, just to give you a picture of how different his pace was from his crazy escape, he traveled about 200 miles in this 40 days. His escape, he traveled 100 miles, over 100 miles, in fact, which is just under half of that, and he probably did it in just a couple days. So you have moving from this insane escape into slow and meaningful, intentional journey. All right? So he begins to move past this. This was a much slower journey, and it was the journey that was long and difficult, but in the end, God revealed himself to Elijah, though maybe not how Elijah had expected that God would do this. There he went into the cave, and he spent the night. And the word of the Lord came to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" I love this question, because God didn't tell Elijah to run. He didn't tell him to run from Jezebel. It was Elijah's own fear and anger and disillusion that caused him to do that. His escape was more an escape from motivated by disillusionment. It was an escape from God, not an escape out of fear from Jezebel in the end. It was an escape from God and his calling. Really, any escape that we make is an escape from God, because God is already right here. No matter what you're going through, no matter what your disillusionment is, God is already here. So any escape that we try to make from it is an escape from God himself. And he replied, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty." This is Elijah's answer to God. What are you doing here? "The Israelites have rejected your covenant. They've broken down your altars and put your prophets to death with the sword. I'm the only one left. And now they're trying to kill me, too." And you can just hear his disillusionment and his anger coming out in this, almost blaming God for this. You know, "The Israelites rejected your covenant. I'm the only one left. They're trying to kill me." You can hear almost self-pity creeping in there. And so this is what God says to him. "The Lord said, 'Go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by.' Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after that, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. And then God asked him the same thing. 'What are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here?'" See, all the things that God causes here are things from the past. The wind was when God created the storm for Elijah and brought the rain. The earthquake happened at this very mountain when the earth shook, when God gave the Ten Commandments to the people of Israel. The fire was the fire that God consumed the sacrifice with. But God wasn't in any of those things. See, Elijah was used to experiencing God in those kind of ways. But he wasn't used to experiencing God in this way, in the small whisper. Sometimes those same hyper-real expectations that make us think that life should always be amazing and this buzz, right? We have those same expectations about our physical lives. We think that our spiritual lives, right, just like our physical lives, our spiritual lives should also be full of buzz, entertaining, new and exciting and flashy. But that's just not the way it is most of the time. See, mostly God speaks in gentle whispers, preceded by very long periods of our obedience to what he has already told us to do. And mostly, God does work through the mundane, through the ordinary. But this is good news, because mostly our lives are lived in the ordinary. And God, no matter what it is, God is right there, present in it with us, working through it to us. He's present with us in all of it, and not just the big things. See, worshiping and following Jesus are at their very core about taking every single moment of our lives and living that moment for God, the big ones and the small ones. I love this passage in the Message translation. So here's what I want you to do, God helping you. Take your everyday, ordinary life, your sleeping, eating, going to work, and walking around life, and place it before God as an offering. See, Elijah learns that God and all of God's power is with him right now in the quiet, and not just when miraculous things are happening. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Then a voice said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" The same question. And the answer is exactly the same answer. Now, don't miss what's going on here. This isn't just an answer that Elijah is giving. It's a question. It's a challenge. He is challenging God, okay? And this is what he's saying to him. He's saying something that comes to the very heart of all of Elijah's disillusionment. He's saying, "Aren't you going to fix what's going on here? Life isn't the way it's supposed to be. Things are messed up here. When are you going to fix this?" His answer is a challenge. In our disillusionment, we might ask the same question from God. "God, my world is messed up. Are you really going to fix this? Can I trust you?" Now look at the way that God responds to Elijah. And this might not seem like a response at first, but we'll look into it. "Then the Lord said to him, 'Go back the way you came and go to the desert of Damascus. And when you get there, anoint Hazael king over Aram.'" Now, basically, what he says is, in response to Elijah, "Go back the way you came and anoint this guy king." All right? In other words, his answer is A, go back to where I told you to be before you ran away. And B, yes, I am going to fix it. And you are going to be involved in my fixing it. Now go anoint this guy king. He expected Elijah to be involved. See, we've seen Elijah's experience, but as we close, we need to talk about our experience. How do I choose meaningful journey over escape? The first part of this is that we need to saturate ourselves in God's presence. We need to pay attention to what disillusions us and what we use for escape. The first part is just noticing those things. And when we notice that we're about to start escaping, we need to intentionally run to God instead. Go find somewhere quiet, away from your escape method, and pray. Read scripture. Call a wise friend and talk. See, escape brings numbing. But filling yourself with God's presence brings healing. Let me give you an example. Escaping is like a man who always drinks coffee and never water. He's constantly on the buzz, right? And he needs it. And he goes out one day and he mows the lawn and it's 90 degrees and he comes in and it's sweaty and he's dehydrated and he comes in and he says, "Oh, I just think I want a big glass of steaming hot coffee." And we're like, "Oh, that's gross. He needs water to refresh himself." And yet we do the same thing by escaping. Let me give you another example. Escaping is like a runner who always feels the searing pain in her leg when she starts running. And yet, every day, she pops painkillers and then goes out and runs even further than she did the day before. What's wrong with this picture? Well, we know that all that's going to do is numb the pain, and eventually she's going to tear a muscle and be out of commission and not even be able to run anymore because she numbed the pain instead of dealing with it. We have to deal with it. First, we need to saturate ourselves with God's presence. Second, we need to become involved in God's purpose. Elijah told God how messed up everything was. "God, life is so messed up. And God answered Elijah's challenge by giving him responsibility in fixing the problem. So I'm going to let you in on something. Do you know why we have that nagging feeling that life just isn't the way it should be? It's because it's not. It's because life isn't the way it should be. Ever since sin and evil entered the world at the fall, when Adam and Eve sinned, this world has been cursed by its effects. Life has been messed up. God didn't design this world, or us for that matter, to experience suffering and disease and pain and death. His purpose, His plan for this world, is that this world is going to be renewed. See, God is going to renew the world, and He wants us to be involved in it. He's going to give us responsibility in making it happen, just like He gave Elijah the responsibility of being involved so many years earlier. So listen to what's going to happen from Revelation 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. And by the way, this is a prophecy. This prophecy is just as sure to happen as all the prophecies that were fulfilled when Jesus came the first time. Jesus talks in his parables about coming back and reigning for the second time. And we read this. This is the second to last chapter in the Bible. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Now the dwelling of God is with men, and He will live with them. They will be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." And then He said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." This is why Jesus taught us to pray, "Your kingdom come, Your will be done on earth just as it is in heaven." Because His kingdom is coming here, and His kingdom begins with our being involved in God's dream for the world right here and right now. When we saturate ourselves with God's presence and we get involved in God's purpose, then we're going to find that we don't need to run anymore.
By understanding God's reality, we see that God has a dream for this world, and our deepest desires and needs are met through that dream. The fantastic thing is that God doesn't expect us through our own human effort to move our whole lives into His reality. No, He meets us along the way. And we're told through Scripture that one day Jesus will return and the whole world will be enveloped by God's reality. The Bible tells us that when Christ returns, justice will flow like a river.